could have been William O'Neill, who wrote something along the lines of, you know, most of the work that people do on equities is spent, you know, bottoms up research of the individual companies. And yet the vast majority of the move in any individual stock price is a result of, you know, the macroeconomic, you know, forces, the liquidity and whatever that are, you know, affecting that industry specifically. It's not company specific alpha. So if everybody's spending their efforts on that small amount of move in an individual stock, and I spend all my efforts on the big picture, you know, I don't have to be as right to, I guess, do better.
Today's episode is sponsored by Relay Human Cloud, a leading provider of staff hosting and related services to simplify and de-risk the process of adding remote overseas workers. Stay tuned to the end of this episode, and you'll be able to hear more about Relay Human Cloud, what they do, and how they've helped businesses like mine, Fort Capital. We're offering an exclusive promo code for the fans of this show, so make sure to stick around for that to receive $500 off per employee per year. One of my favorite things to do is raise capital. Always been something I love doing. I love putting together deals. But one thing that is always tough for me is putting together the actual pitch deck, which is really important when you're raising capital. Or whether it's a corporate overview or a track record deck or investor reporting collateral, but putting together any kind of deck for guys like me has always just been tough. And so finding a company that could do it, and not only do it, but blow your mind and make some of the best pitch decks you've ever seen, was really cool. Enter Better Pitch. Better Pitch has taken the lead and is making some of the best pitch books I've ever seen. And if you think that not having a great pitch book is important when either raising capital, showing off your company, showing off your track record, showing off to investors, you're mistaken. I think your pitch book is one of the most important pieces of collateral that you could have. So I highly recommend checking out Better Pitch. They have an incredible team. They will work with you. And if you're a Fort listener, and you tell them that, they will work with you on as many revisions as you need until you're 100% satisfied. So go check them out. One of the great joys of my life has been building Fort Capital, something that I have loved for a long time. One of the best parts about it is building it with our incredibly talented team across three offices, Fort Worth, Dallas, and Houston, and our team abroad. We've built an incredible enterprise focused around a mission of being the best real estate operator in the world. We really believe the better that we get at operating, the better that we get in investing. We've built some incredible technology that gives us the ability to see data that others can't and operate our company as efficiently as possible and deliver better customer service to our tenants and really everybody involved. If you want to know more about our thesis, I encourage you to go to our website, fortcapitallp.com, where we talk about why we've been investing in Class B industrial real estate since 2016, hyper-focused on it. You can learn how you can help us find deals, more about our technology and how we think about it. You can see job openings. Highly encourage you to check out our newsletter or follow us on LinkedIn. And you can do all of this by going to fortcapitallp.com. All right, Mark, thanks for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
For those listening, one of the most fun I've had over the last decade is when you invite me to just come hang out with you on the trading floor. And I think we've been doing that now for like 10 years. So getting to do this today is really cool. Let's just start with really career. How did you get into macro hedge fund investing?
That's a good question. Well, I started off my career as an investment banker. And my goal, I guess, always since I was a little kid was to manage money. And, you know, I grew up in Fort Worth, you know, Richard Rainwater, I think maybe the greatest investor of the 20th century, you know, lived here. His son was in my class in school. My father, you know, grew up with Richard and was his lawyer. And so, you know, David Bonderman moved to town later on. You had like Harlan Cornvase and HBK here and Clint Carlson, some, you know, even a little bit later, but some really legendary kind of money managers were here in Fort Worth that, you know, I was aware of, kind of knew, you know, and so it was funny. We had 35 boys in my high school class, and at one point, seven of the 35 were working at hedge funds on the investment side.
Wow.
So it's, I think a lot of people in my class were sort of influenced by, you know, Rainwater and kind of wanting to get into that. And so I guess, you know, in college, my goal was to get a job, you know, on Wall Street doing, you know, M&A investment banking to try to, you know, put myself on the track to eventually, you know, get into money management. And I worked, you know, was an investment banker for about 3 years and then transitioned over to work for a guy named Kerry Stokes, who's a Australian kind of media / mining magnate. He had bought MGM Studios with Kurt Kerkorian, and I had a particular, you know, I was in the entertainment M&A and had a particular understanding of the company, MGM. And so once he bought it, he hired me to kind of come help oversee it, get it public, you know, et cetera. So I worked, I guess, closely with some of the C-level executives there. It didn't last that long, but a friend of mine from high school is a few years older than me. He and another guy in Dallas had been managing a little bit of money and wanted to start a, you know, an official hedge fund. And they kind of recruited me to, you know, come over and kind of be their, you know, junior partner and sort of like CFO, COO, and kind of provide some fundamental research for them, you know? And so that was kind of, you know, the opportunity I was looking for. And what was interesting to me, these guys were really good traders, moneymakers, absolute moneymakers, but they weren't kind of your traditional, you know, Harvard MBA kind of deep, like fundamental, you know, build models and whatnot. They were much more kind of top down and used a lot of technical analysis. And my passion had always been like macroeconomics and geopolitics. And so, you know, kind of what they were doing was a lot more interesting to me, and they were making money. And so, you know, I kind of just, I don't know, a little bit of an autodidact, I guess, just trying to figure out how things went and just kind of constantly reading tons of books and kind of paying attention to the world and seeing how it fit together, and started, you know, kind of developed my own strategy, I guess, that way. And after a few years of working with them, I sold my stake in that fund back to my partners and started Corriente, which was in July of 2001. And kind of been at it since with a, you know, brief hiatus.
You remember how old you were when you first thought, I'm going to manage money? Was this like as like a 10-year-old or a...
Yeah, probably, or younger. I mean, I never thought, really had any other career goals other than running money that I can recall.
Rainwater is obviously Fort Worth's probably most iconic investor. You said your dad was his attorney. So there's only one son of the attorney of Rainwater. Like, what do you think you got to observe from that position to see what an icon looked like in the investing world at that early? I'm sure your dad, just being around that, brought stories home or just vibes home that obviously made you want to manage money.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure, you know, Rainwater had plenty of lawyers, but yeah, there was one like crazy story, I guess. I can, you know, reason I can't tell this, but so, and if I get the details off, I apologize, but but it was when the Bass family ended up buying a big stake of Disney, and the way they had done it, they bought a company called Arvida Land, which is a big land company, owned a lot of land in Florida, and I think there was a green mailer who essentially had been buying a bunch of Disney shares, and, you know, was threatening to take it over unless they bought him out at a premium. And so Rainwater, I guess, conceived of this plan to sweep in as like a white squire. And so it was a white knight, which would come in and buy the company. A white squire would come in and buy enough of the company to make it too expensive for the green mailer. And essentially, you know, my dad worked on writing up whatever legal documents it was. And that night at about, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, Richard Rainwater comes over to our house, picks up the documents, and gets on a plane. You know, flies to New York, and like at 8 or 8:30 in the morning, like, you know, goes into the board meeting at Disney to, you know, essentially make his proposal on how to save the company. And, you know, the rest is history. I mean, they ended up buying a huge portion of Disney, and it was a wild success over many years.
I've heard like bits and pieces of that story. Wasn't it something along the lines of Disney was also treating the land on their books at like $10 an acre or something, and it was worth thousands of dollars per acre? So just that alone, there was this huge value accretion.
That could be it. I'm not sure how it worked exactly, actually. I haven't heard the details on it. It was just this sort of story. It was really kind of awesome, you know.
Yeah.
Working, you know, middle of the night, drafting these docs, like bursting into the board meeting. It's like a, you know, an 80s, like, you know, Wall Street drama almost.
What's a green mailer?
Well, a green mailer, just somebody that would come in and buy a large stake in a company and then threaten to try to do a hostile takeover of the company.
Got it.
Unless the company buys back the shares at a premium.
Got it.
And so just, I don't know if that's a common thing these days. I haven't heard about that in a long time.
Well, that's probably a good lead into Corriente and macro. Is like, there's always something going on in macro, even in the middle of the night. Macro mm-hmm. stories don't stop when we go to bed.
It's true.
Okay, so you start 2001. Maybe before we get into like how Corriente evolved, how do you think about research? Like, there's tons going on in the world, or maybe you would say there's actually not a lot going on in the world. There's always just a few things going on, but you got to know what they are. So how do you, when I ask you what macro is, how do you think about it?
Well, that's a good question. I tried to think of, you know, what are the really, you know, driving, you know, main driving forces, you know, of the world, of, you know, geopolitics, of macro, what, you know, whether it's, I mean, if some of the big things, like the biggest probably right now is this, you know, this rivalry that's, you know, I would call it at minimum a Cold War with China and the Chinese axis and Russia, North Korea, Iran, et cetera. And, you know, not that, you know, it affects the way governments act, the way trade happens. I mean, there's a million different things that something like that would, you know, impact. Or, you know, Mark Andreessen, you know, a decade or so ago wrote, maybe 12 years ago, wrote an essay called Software is Eating the World. And this whole, you know, concept of how software is transforming like lots of other, you know, different types of companies and how, and so these are the sort of, you know, tailwinds. These are going to stay, these, you know, these are constants, you know, in the economy that are not going to stop. And so what are those big forces that, you know, continue to, you know, kind of drive social behavior? And so that's kind of like, you know, at a very big picture. And then where are the inefficiencies, you know, in the market? A lot of times those inefficiencies are caused by, you know, bad policy. And it's a function of, you know, this is not going to last forever, but when's it going to unwind? And how do I figure out, you know, that? So like a lot of, for me, you know, it's been just finding specific themes where I see, you know, big inefficiencies maybe that have been there for a long time, and then trying to figure out, you know, when they're going to kind of become efficient again, how to time that some more.
Are you looking for things in a macro view that nobody's seeing, or are you okay just diving into what's already known but finding your spot kind of in that theme?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, you know, it doesn't have to be something that, you know, nobody's seen, although it feels a lot better, you know, to not be with the crowd, like to feel like you're really onto something that, you know, not many people are talking about or really thinking about. You know, I mean, I always thought that, like, you know, I'm relatively smart, but I'm not like the smartest guy. And, you know, I'm a hard worker, but I'm not the hardest worker. So how can I, you know, be the best at what I do? And I think that the answer is that, you know, you just got to be different. You know, you have to take a different approach. I always thought that, you know, I think it was like Ned Davis or somebody who wrote something along the lines of, could have been William O'Neill, who wrote something along the lines of, you know, most of the work that people do on equities is spent, you know, bottoms up research of the individual companies. And yet the vast majority of the move in any individual stock price is a result of, you know, the macroeconomic, you know, forces, the liquidity and whatever that are, you know, affecting that industry specifically. It's not company specific alpha. So if everybody's spending their efforts on that small amount of move in an individual stock, and I spend all my efforts on the big picture, you know, I don't have to be as right to, I guess.
Is it lonely?
Do better. I don't find it lonely.
Or maybe is it lonely to be so convicted on something that the world's not seeing yet? Or do you like that feeling of kind of being in isolation? We're going to talk about 08 in a bit, but yeah. I would imagine there was a time where the housing prices are going crazy and you're like, I mean, if anybody's seen The Big Short or read any of these books, like it was clear as day to you that it was going to crash. But there was probably a year or two where everybody was just laughing at you. Like, look at Mark over there betting against the housing when
You know, we were fairly lucky in that specific instance because, you know, sort of right after we got the bet on, it started working. It didn't really go against us for very long. It's something we watched for a long time, but it had, you know, I've suffered big drawdowns, big losses that, you know, weren't ever recouped because, you know, either timing was wrong or the thesis was wrong. And yeah, that's really, you know, tough. It's been a, it's something, I don't know if lonely, I mean, I've always had, you know, good support and professional support, you know, people with whom I've collaborated. And so I guess, you know, if misery loves company, there's always a little bit of company, you know, with me when things weren't right. But I mean, you want people to agree with you, you know, later,
yeah,
you know, and so that's part of the deal.
Okay, well, let's go back a second. So tell me, like, how the research began or the theme began against housing. You kind of started, sure, betting, I think, or investing in 06 in a,
that's right,
a collapse, but that thesis probably started in what, 04, 05?
Well, I mean, even before then, although I wasn't betting against housing, I had been thinking about it since at least January of 03, maybe, oh, wow, or so. I can't remember. You can go back and look. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal by a guy named Patrick Barta, who's a good friend of mine in college. And, you know, I think it was in January of 03, but we were having, you know, drinks in New York, and I was explaining this housing thesis like in 03 to him, and he ended up writing a story about it. Didn't mention my name, but it was obviously pretty early on. I was wrong, you know, at the time. But, you know, I was very long a lot of commodities in the mid, and I knew that a lot of that demand was coming from, you know, the booming housing market. And so I realized that that was a big risk to my thesis. And so I guess always out like looking for, you know, signs that that was going to be turning. And I was certainly, you know, expecting to find signs that that something was going to happen at some point. And that was, you know, my friend Kyle Bass, we, you know, talked all the time back then. And so we were kind of both, you know, doing really well on this commodities trade and both very, you know, kind of nervous, and people knew that. And so we were able to, you know, I guess see enough. I mean, the signs were there, you know, it was really.
What were the signs to you?
God, I can't remember all the signs. I mean, you were starting to see, though, you know, credit spreads starting to move wider on some of the, you know, riskiest types names, but you're, you know, I think delinquencies. And I mean, a lot of just the credit data was deteriorating even before you were seeing really the credit markets reflected. And sentiment was very extreme. And I always look to, you know, I always say that, like, you know, everybody wants to be a contrarian, you know, and a lot of times, you know, you'll be in a room and you ask a group full of, you know, bears why they're bearish, and they'll say, because everybody else is bullish. And then bulls at the same time will say they're bullish because everybody else is bearish. But really, you know, maybe there's not, you know, a clear read from sentiment at being at an extreme, but it's kind of like the Supreme Court's definition of pornography. It's like, you know it when you see it. And, you know, this was a time when everybody in the mortgage market and the whole loan departments at different banks would swear up and down that on a nationwide basis, on average, you know, housing prices can't drop. Like, literally, their models, they didn't even go negative, you know? It's like, yeah, you know, if one pocket of the housing market is weak out in California, well, it'll be strong in Texas or whatever, but never across the board. And so these securitizations, you know, they'd include loans from all over the country. And so they get that geographic diversity. And there's just this view that it was absolutely pervasive that, you know, the worst case scenario was slow growth. And so it seemed that we had that kind of perfect sentiment set up, you know, right at the time that all the data was deteriorating. And I guess people were just flying a little bit blind.
But you were like in the 0.001% of people that still saw you make it. I mean, from your advantage, it's easy. So what gave you the, like, all right, we're going to raise money around this idea and we're convicted and we're going? Was there another inflection point, or it was just a series of all these kind of seeings of data?
Well, I mean, to me, it was seeing the optionality, you know, in credit default swaps, getting into the instrument and seeing that, you know, the payoff if you were right. And it just seemed the risk reward was completely out of whack. I mean, you could buy, you know, insurance policies essentially on bonds where you know what your worst case scenario it is. It's just spending premium, you know, but your upside is epic. And the way that the kind of bond waterfalls flow, like you would have the lowest grade bonds get completely wiped out before the next grade would even get impaired at all. So it wouldn't take much carnage to have like full defaults on some of the lower rated tranches of these, you know, subprime RMBS. So I think it was more the instrument was so compelling that we found to give us an incredible kind of risk reward setup that really was the key.
So when you're going around and your pitch is like kind of like the world's about to fall apart or the housing market, maybe you didn't know the gravity of what 08 would turn into, but you at least knew housing was going to, and you're sitting in front of investors that are probably, you know, they enjoy like an up into the right thing. Mm-hmm. Were most people investing with you as a hedge against their optimism, or was everybody like, oh, we see it too, or we like Mark? Like, I just have to imagine to have the guts to put money into that investment where the world was in 06, you're taking if you're not already as deep into it as you, like you're feeling like, okay, I guess this is a hedge on my optimism.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people did see it that way. They saw, okay, well, look, I mean, the payout's so huge. You know, if they're right about the housing market, the payout's so epic, but the consequences for the rest of my portfolio are so bad, you know, it makes sense. I think we did have, you know, a good number of hedgers. And then, you know, we probably had a lot of, you know, individual investors who, you know, just loved the risk reward setup,
yeah,
which was so good.
Do you think, just psychologically, do you think it was a good thing that you were right so quickly?
Well, you know, I was right so quickly on that trade, and then right after it, the Europe trade. And, you know, it was really, yeah, I mean, that probably made me, you know, tried to keep my ego in check as much as possible. And, you know, obviously, like, you know, it's not like I just came up with these things. I mean, it was collaborative efforts and whatnot. And probably more of it was, you know, my willingness to just like go big,
yep,
you know, my kind of personality, as opposed to, you know, being like so brilliant. I didn't really think of it. I guess it made me overconfident. I, you know, later on, obviously had the big, you know, short on the Chinese yuan that cost me a lot of money. And I don't think I was wrong on the thesis. Still may play out. You had, you know, the Shanghai Accord in 2016, which was essentially, you know, massive intervention by Western powers to avoid a Chinese, you know, yuan devaluation. But at the same time, you know, I had put this trade on like 6 years before that anyway. So it's way early at best, you know, or you could say I was just completely wrong. But there's no question that I think, thinking back, that I would have won it. I should have, you know, like waited for more cards to come out of the deck, you know, before, you know, pressing that next bet.
What's the quote? The difference between being wrong and early is indiscernible.
I mean, that's right. It was wrong. Like, it was a total wipeout, or virtually a total wipeout, my China bet. And you still, you know, and there actually was a devaluation. It wasn't enough to really move the needle, but yeah.
Besides being early on China, though, what did the whole China thing maybe teach you about the world, or teach you about how governments work? Or because eventually you were right. You were just early in making the call of what happened.
Yeah.
Now, as you sit and look at macro, like, that's obviously a new tool that you bring to the table when you're looking at a situation that things can probably take a lot longer to play out. Was there something you left that situation with that will be a tool in your tool chest going forward?
Well, it's a good question.
I've got a lot of good questions for you.
Yeah. Well, you can always learn a lot from your, I mean, everything has to be like a victory or a lesson. There are probably a lot of, you know, lessons that I learned. I think, you know, maybe some of the more important lessons didn't have to do with investing as much as, like, you know, I had three little kids, I had two dying parents, unfortunately, and I, you know, was sort of obsessed with these trades that, you know, really were kind of out of my hands, whether they worked or not, for a long time. And so I think, you know, maybe that kind of helped wake me up to, you know, pursuing kind of quality of life, health, that sort of thing, like a little bit more family time. You know, I took a hiatus for a while, really, to mostly focus on, you know, family and health after that China trade.
Let's go back a second just to Europe. So you and then we're going to get back to where we just were, but you run a great trade on the housing decline, which basically as that trade was going on, you were already beginning the trade on Europe. Is that correct?
Yeah.
What'd you see there?
Well, I saw that, you know, there were a lot of, you know, credit bubbles in the world, that it wasn't just U.S. housing. And I'd always, interestingly, since college, I had thought about the European divergence trade in a sense. I was at a finance class, and it was happening during when the Maastricht Treaty was signed. And it was a small class of like four or five students in the class. And we spent, one of the students in our class was from Germany, and we spent a lot of time talking about it. And this idea of, you know, multiple fiscal policies and a single monetary policy, you know, seemed like, you know, it can't last forever, you know, if because you have these different countries that have different, you know, economic fundamentals, you know, but yet the goal is sort of to drive borrowing costs to the same level. And so the convergence trade lasted for a long, long time, but I assumed that eventually, you know, it couldn't last. So it was the kind of thing that was in the back of my mind for a long time, that this would happen. Wasn't really thinking about playing it or anything. But then I read a book, a short little book, I can't remember the name of the book, but the author was Louis Vincent Gave, who's a close friend of mine, really great, you know, macro thinker. And he had moved, actually, he and his family moved to Hong Kong from France, and thought that was Asia was the future. And, you know, in his book, discussed some of the, you know, risks and problems in the European sovereign bond market. So I read the book and started doing a deep dive. And the more I, you know, read and figured out how, you know, the sausage was made over there, the more I was convinced that, you know, it had to, you know, blow up. And so I started to prepare for that fund. I recruited Louis to join me on managing that fund. And then it was kind of slow moving. I don't know if I'm answering your question exactly, but it's kind of slow moving until that summer of 2008. And I was just watching the credit spreads, not of the countries that are in the EMU, the Economic Monetary Union, but, you know, the countries that had hoped to get into the EMU, like the, you know, Bulgaria's, Romania's, Latvia's. And suddenly, you know, that July, you just had, you know, spreads over German bonds like blowing out. So like, I remember, like, you know, 7-year, you know, like Bulgaria over Germany went from like trading flat to trading like 15 or 20 basis points over, you know, and nobody was paying attention. And you look at these charts after a convergence for, you know, decades, or not quite decades, but of borrowing costs, suddenly out of nowhere, right in the heels of the subprime and with all the banking crisis here, suddenly those credit spreads widening. You know, it seemed like the dam had broken, or was about to break. And that was kind of the catalyst to really, you know, raise the money fast and put it to work.
And maybe we can pick on, this goes back to the research question. This is just for me. I'm, you know, I buy real estate around Texas. My research is kind of like down the street. I can drive to my research. But when you're doing research on something, to the average person that's complex, it's across the world, you're dealing with like government policy. How are you doing that? Are you calling people over in Europe? You obviously read a book, which led you to other things. Like, what all goes into a full research to where you come out going, okay, green light?
Yeah. I mean, we had analysts, you know, reading, you know, bond prospectuses. We spent a lot of time with, you know, the trading desks of all the big firms that traded these sovereign bonds and traded, you know, sovereign CDS. We had to dive deep into the instrument, you know, how's the default like become official? How does it, what triggers the CDS? We spent time talking to the sovereign credit rating analysts, like at Moody's and various places. It was just, you know, basically learning everything you can, your whole team, and knowing, getting to know the people on the trading desks that trade the stuff. And, you know, I mean, I think what was really interesting and the mind-boggling thing was that European sovereign bonds had no, it was not the process, this is like a light bulb, is that the European sovereign bonds have no risk weighting. And so what you can do is you could buy a European sovereign bond if it's an EMU bond, and you could immediately take it to the ECB and borrow money against it. The 100% face value, there's zero haircut. So there's zero risk weighting. Mm-hmm. So what banks and, you know, banks in Europe had been doing the same stuff that banks in here in the United States had, you know, lending to bad credits for a long time. And so, but what they were able to do, and these were, the banks in Europe were much larger balance sheets than the banks in the United States. But what they could do is they could create tier one capital. In other words, you know, the equivalent of equity, you know, by selling CDS, because you're selling CDS, you're selling an insurance product, right? And so, and when you sell it, you get a stream of payments, right? And so they could take the stream of payments and present value the stream of payments. And since there was zero risk to the bonds, as determined by the ECB, you could actually like create a net positive value that counted essentially as equity, tier one capital on your balance sheet. And so that's what these, you know, banks, particularly like in land banks in Germany, were doing, but a lot of them were. So, you know, kind of what happened is when, you know, the banks, maybe the ECB looks at it that way, but as the banks started to wonder about their counterparties, you know, when credit spreads started to blow out, they started to ask for more collateral, which they didn't have.
Okay. Sidebar. Yeah. So you talked about being at the top of your game, and then a few years after, you, we'll call it maybe not rock bottom, but you hit a low.
Yeah.
I want to talk about what you did. You hired a, and one thing you always say is, I've noticed, I wrote this down, every author that you read that you like becomes like one of your friends. But you essentially read a book, I have it in here, by Josh Whiteskin,
yep,
who introduced you to Tim Ferriss. And when we were talking a couple weeks ago at lunch, you're like, I invited these guys into my life to help me rebuild kind of my process and the way I approach life. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about like what that all looked like and how your life changed?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I just knew that I had to, like, you know, I was very spread out. I had a lot of employees and I had, you know, a lot of chaos, and I really didn't feel like I was on top of it. And so I read the book, The Art of Learning by Josh Whiteskin, and I was blown away by it. And, you know, Josh was, you know, he was the subject of the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer. So he was this phenom chess player, the, I think, 7-time scholastic champion in the U.S. This movie came out and it was a big hit, and it was a book. It was written by his father, and it kind of caused him to lose the love of chess. And so he got into, you know, martial arts, long story, and ended up, you know, becoming a world champion, and wrote a book about his, you know, learning process. And I realized, you know, that I needed that. And so, yeah. And so I, you know, they made a lot of recommendations. They looked at, you know, my life, how I broke my day down and how my team broke their day down, and, you know, and divided it into, you know, exercise, work, family, whatever it was. And then made a bunch of recommendations about how I can improve, you know, a lot of those processes, you know, diet, exercise, you know, how to get the, you know, most, you know, quality out of, you know, research time and whatnot. And so,
what's the biggest needle mover that, if you had to say, there's probably a lot, but what was like the one big thing that changed it all? Is it exercise?
Yeah. I mean, jiu-jitsu was like the big thing. I mean, I just became like completely obsessed, as you know.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think so many guys on Wall Street get into jiu-jitsu?
Well, you know, it's really uncomfortable. And, or it can be, when you're getting choked or you're twisted around, you can't move, you can't breathe, or you can't breathe well. And it's like really easy to panic, but you really have to, you know, get your mind to a place where you're not. And it's, I mean, you immediately shut out everything, you know, and you just become the ego, all of it. And you just become like, and it's super complicated, complex, you know, it looks like, you know, fairly basic maybe if you're watching it, but like the more you get into it, the more there is to it. It just keeps getting deeper and deeper. And so it's like puzzling. It's a challenge. I mean, people call it like 3D chess or whatnot. And that, I mean, I'm not a chess player, but that makes intuitive, you know, sense to me. It's exhausting, and, you know, you get in phenomenal shape and it unlocks, you know, athleticism that, you know, I guess that I didn't know that I had. And so, and I loved the, you know, the people that do it, I guess.
How long did it take you to become a black belt?
It took me 8 years to become black belt, which is fast, but I did spend, you know, 4.5 years, you know, doing twice a day for, you know, total 3 or 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. So it was like really, and I'd been a wrestler before in high school and done some other martial arts, did judo as a kid. So I kind of,
I will have memories of you forever. Every time I'd come visit, you'd be walking out of the dojo, like sweaty, like clearly had been doing, and then we'd walk like right onto the trading floor and you'd start checking what's mm-hmm. going on there. And then we'll talk about your one wheel, but I thought it's one of the most unique like setups I've seen. You can literally train next door and then walk straight into work.
That's right.
And I'm assuming that's had a huge positive impact on
Absolutely.
How you work.
Absolutely. You know, the jiu-jitsu slack lines. I don't know if you ever do a slack line, like a little tightrope type thing. I mean, they're awesome for, I mean, balance, but also just something to like take your mind off of everything that's going on. So I have slack lines, you know, at the office and mats and gym. And yeah, sometimes just go clear the head with some of that.
What can a black belt do? Like, how do you know you've become a black belt?
Well, aside from getting, you know,
there's certain checklists you have to be able to do X, Y, and Z, or like, how do you prove that? Like, obviously you have to get every belt before that, but what defines a black belt?
Yeah. I mean, there may be, I actually don't know the specific, like if there's certain, you know, specific, I mean, there are different, like people may have different definitions. There's the, but I mean, you pretty much have to be, you know, proficient, and like I don't know what I specifically like did or skills I had. There wasn't like a test that I went through. However, I mean, to some extent there is, and that, you know, my teachers like, you know, basically made sure that I kind of was there. Yeah and multiple, you know, agreed that this time.
All right, I want to now go back maybe to China, but not necessarily to talk about the trade. It's mm-hmm. now like 2024. You kind of said we've been a Cold War, and really a lot of our discussions over the years when we're talking just about the world has China involved in it.
Yep.
You probably think about China a lot.
I do.
How do you think about them today in 2024?
That's a long answer. You know, I think that...
And we have time. I mean, you don't have to give me the hour-long answer. We'll do it at lunch, but... Give me as much as you want to give me.
Well, you know, conflict is, and it has been for a long time, and China has been building up its military capabilities for a very long time. And it's allied with a lot of countries who are increasingly, you know, at war, or, you know, whether it's Venezuela, you know, threatening to, you know, take parts of Guyana, or, you know, Hamas, you know, attacking Israel, proxy of Iran in a sense, or it's, you know, all these different conflicts, I think, are serving China's interests in that the United States is getting spread out. And at the same time, the United States hasn't, you know, invested in, you know, maintaining a lot of its strengths, military strengths. And certainly our allies are even, you know, more guilty of not investing in their strength. So I don't know if it means that we go to hot war, or if the U.S. ever gets to that, or it just makes the U.S. in a weaker, you know, negotiating position. But I think that one of the things that's happened that's kind of scary is China's model has been to suck in capital from the West and then, you know, use that to build out its own industries to compete with the West, and then also use that to invest in other countries to, you know, gain allies and to make those other countries sort of dependent on China. And the capital flows into China have, you know, stopped in many ways. There's still capital goes in, but it's still more and more through the trade account, you know, running bigger and bigger trade surpluses. And so, you know, that is a little scary because one, like maybe the game's up a little bit in terms of people starting to recognize that, you know, it's kind of a roach motel. If you send your investments in, you know, the money doesn't come out. And so China needing to, I guess, make up for it with the lack of dollars with, you know, mercantilist, you know, trade policies. And so, you know, of course, that is not politically, you know, palatable to, you know, countries in Europe or the United States who, you know, big car manufacturers, and suddenly, you know, that's reversing and they're importing a lot of cars from China. Tensions are rising. They're going to continue to rise. I don't know, you know, how it comes to a head or if we reach a state of, you know, detente. I think that it's, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a believer in this, you know, kind of fourth turning type idea where, you know, I think we're in that fourth turning where a lot of, you know, institutions of the prior, you know, several generations are destroyed and new ones are created and it's happening, you know, a lot of things are causing that to happen. China's, you know, one of them. So it's, you know, I think that really part of it is, you know, you have to think about with it as an investor, not so much, you know, it's more like how do you invest in this environment when the geopolitical risks are rising? And that's kind of maybe the best answer. Yeah.
When Xi Jinping came over to San Francisco a couple months ago and they cleared downtown and that had been riddled with homelessness and drugs, and then that we were told forever, well, it just kind of, that's the state. And then in 24 hours, it was cleaned up for the Communist Party to, from a trader macro perspective, how did you read that? Is that, that's obviously appears weakness.
Yeah.
Why did we do that?
Well, I mean, I guess that's sort of the practice. I mean, it's for foreign leaders, but it does, like, you know, it draws it's not a good look, I don't think. If you can clean up for a foreign adversary who wants to take you down, but you can't clean up for your own citizens. I guess the main thing, like outside of like Bitcoin, for me, the biggest, you know, macro theme that's investable is this, you know, migration to, you know, Texas and to other states. And the way I think about it is sort of a, you know, as a taxpayer, you know, you are, when you pay taxes, you're making an investment where you live. It's, you have to, but it's still, that's what you're doing. And I can go into why, but so like, think about countries like, you know, Monaco or the Caymans or, you know, Switzerland or Ireland, you know, they're tax havens, and a lot of businesses or elite, you know, global elite people have, you know, moved their assets and moved themselves physically to some extent to some of these tax havens. But that really hasn't been much of an issue for, you know, non-elites who are less mobile. You're kind of tied into where you are, generally speaking. And I think that the pandemic really changed a lot. One of the big changes is we came to realize that we didn't have to spend as much time in the office to be efficient. So a new kind of equilibrium is figured out. And I think, like, the pandemic suddenly created, you know, more demand for residential real estate and at the same time, less demand for commercial real estate. In other words, you know, individuals thought, oh my God, I don't have enough space at home, you know, because of lockdowns or whatever, or the businesses realized, oh, I got too much space at the office. So suddenly we were short residential real estate and long commercial real estate. And that unlocking also of not having to be, you know, more people being able to work, you know, kind of remotely sort of set off, you know, a little bit of a tax arbitrage, you know, where suddenly taxpayers can say, okay, if I'm not getting a good return on my tax investment where I live, you know, then I just go somewhere else. And so, I mean, I think that there's migration, like, to Texas and, you know, other states, you know, it started with the advent of, you know, air conditioning. because there's much better weather here, except, you know, when it gets really hot, if you've got air conditioning, it's great. So that started it. But now this is kind of this new wave. And, you know, I think like Governor Rick Perry was very focused, for instance, on, you know, his job as governor. He thought, I put words in his mouth, but I thought it was great. His view was, you know, let's attract companies and people who to come here because we have a better business environment for people to work in. But the pandemic has really like set that loose. And I thought that, you know, Xi Jinping's visit to San Francisco was just a very, you know, stark reminder of how poorly taxpayers are treated, you know, in California, or specifically, you know, in San Francisco. There's not a good return on investment. So, I mean, in other words, I guess like this big theme is, for me, is, you know, the first thing I think about is, yes, that theme is correct. Like, this is a long-term thing. It's going to continue to happen. It's cheaper to live here. There are other weird little things like cities like San Francisco, port cities, you know, it used to be really important. All the populations congregated in ports because that was the where the trade met. But then you've had advances in like communication and other things that have not required everybody to be right there where the trade happens. And so, you know, but the downside of that is that you're limited into how you can spread out your population. You have oceans or mountains or whatever that limits. So if you want to take in more people, you have to grow up or out. And so, you know, typically what happens is the wealthiest people can stay sort of there in the city center, and the rank and file have to move further and further away and have longer and longer commutes. And, you know, in Texas, for instance, you don't really have that. Like Fort Worth, Dallas, you've got lots of pockets of industry and wealth spread out all over, and anybody can live pretty close to where they work, regardless of how much money they have. So I think a lot of things are really pushing this, you know, migration trade that will continue for a long time. I don't know if that's
you're making me
coherent.
You're making my heart pitter patter owning real estate in Texas.
Yeah.
What do you think real quick about inflation?
Well, so inflation is how, I mean, we've run up very large debts and are running very large deficits, the government is. And inflation is how historically those debts are paid off. So I always think of inflation as like a tax on owning a currency. So the way I think about it is that actually is that like the tax on owning a currency is inflation plus, you know, productivity in the economy. Or, you know, another way of saying is, you know, the if you had a dollar or $100 basket of goods at the end of a month, at the end of the year, the end of the next year it's $102, then you've had 2% inflation. But if you've had, you know, non-farm productivity growth of 1%, then that basket theoretically should have dropped to $99. So that delta is the tax that you pay on dollars. Well, now what we're in high growth and high real growth and high, you know, inflation. Another way of thinking about it is the cost of holding a dollar is, you know, the rate of nominal GDP. It's real GDP plus, you know, whatever value's added. And so the tax on holding dollars has gone up a lot with inflation. Instead of it being 2.5% or something, it's much higher. And that's obviously caused, you know, people to move into other things like Bitcoin or gold or an out of kind of long duration, you know, reserve assets. But this is, it's how, you know, most people probably don't realize, like in 2020, at the peak of the pandemic, U.S. government debt to GDP hit something like 137%. Do you know what it is now?
I have no idea.
It's like 120. So actually debt to GDP has come down significantly over those last 4 years, even though we've been running big deficits the whole time. And the reason is because the GDP has gone up because of the inflation. So the actual debt burden kind of has been dropping, and that's the game. That's always been the game, is to reduce the value of the obligations, the debt obligations, you know, through inflation. And so I think though it does risk, you know, getting a little bit out of control. you know, supply chains are stretched and we've seen that they can be broken and they can set off inflation. And, you know, it's the, you know, you have like banks that are loaded up with, you know, a lot of commercial real estate that is probably not, you know, appropriately marked, that losses are going to have to come, and the Fed is going to have to be, you know, aware of that as well. So, you know, yeah, you've seen like, but the underlying economy, I mean, is strong. Like, there are a lot of, you know, productivity gains coming from things like AI and just the benefits of investment in technology for a long time. So, you know, I don't know how out of control it gets, but I guess the Fed so far, you know, everybody was expecting cuts to come and interest rates, and they haven't come. So, you know, on the surface, it looks like the Fed is tight or playing tight monetary policy, but that's not really the case. You know, global liquidity has been expanding for about a year and a half. And a reason for that is the rate at which the Fed has been tapering its balance sheet, basically not tapered it nearly as fast. So you've got this issue of maybe being a little tighter at the very front end with interest rates, but providing plenty of liquidity to the economy, you know, in the back end through effectively, you know, quantitative easing.
Yeah, yesterday's print, it was up.
Yeah.
I think in our office, we're not really, again, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we're not really planning for any cuts this year anymore after yesterday.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I had Barry Sternlicht on a few months ago. He probably said it in a way that made them, you know, easy to understand, but he was like, high interest rates don't kill government jobs. They don't kill healthcare jobs. They don't kill our education jobs. They usually will kill the business sector, specifically construction and construction related activities. But when you have a $6 trillion infrastructure bill that you're also pumping into the system, all the big contractors around the country would tell you our business was 80-20 private to public jobs, and now it's just 20-80. And guess who pays the most? The government. Mm-hmm. So you have all these employees that in a typical higher interest rate environment would be getting laid off. They're not only not getting laid off, they're getting paid more to go work on government projects. And so his whole point was like, you can keep raising them and raising them, but it's not, you're kind of pushing on a rope. It's not having the intended consequences on inflation that we would hope for.
Yeah, it's true. Well, they're not really tightening though as well. Yeah. Like through, you know, so, I mean, we track like global liquidity. I think like the best is this Cross-Border Capital, Michael Howell, who monitors it, which is a great like free Twitter follow.
Who is it?
Michael Howell, okay. Cross Borders Capital.
Okay.
But he'll track like global liquidity, which is, you know, it's not just, you know, money supply, but it'll also be like bond volatility, stock volatility, you know, like the lower volatility, the lower volatility an asset is, the better collateral it is. So you can borrow more, you can leverage more against it. And so, you know, global liquidity has been, you know, expanding for a while. It probably will continue to expand for a while to pay for a lot of the, you know, programs. And I mean, the debt has to be monetized one way or another. So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is they're not really like pushing on a string. They're not just, it appears that they're operating in a tighter manner than they actually are.
Okay, let's just talk about Bitcoin. You've been in it for 7-8 years now, maybe longer.
10.
10.
Yeah.
God, those 2014 prices feel good.
Yeah.
But you said that's something you think about a lot. Maybe my first question is, do you think about Bitcoin differently today than you did in 2014, now that you've seen 10 years of how the world's interacted with it, or is it still the same thesis?
Well, it's kind of the same thesis. I mean, I started watching Bitcoin when it was around $1. And I watched it go up for, you know, 40,000% before I bought any, but it was fascinating to me, but just as a project or whatever.
How did you get introduced to it?
My brother-in-law, Blake Lipscomb, okay. Who was my partner at the time as well, somehow came upon, you know, something written about it, and he just kind of started diving into it, and I was fascinated by it. So it really made me actually like create a framework that I use for investing, because, you know, it was funny. There was so much hate for Bitcoin, which made no sense. I mean, I never really got the sort of religious vibe on either side, but it seemed like everybody that loved it was like religious about it, and people that hated it were religious about it, to the point that they, you know, kind of weren't rationally thinking. So you had a picture of like Charlie Munger out there, but Charlie Munger like would never apply any of his actual rules of investing to analyzing it. He just called it double rat poison. And, you know, I actually pointed out to a friend of mine that that was like the worst trade ever. He's been calling it double rat poison since 100. And the friend said to me, well, you know, he wasn't saying it was a bad investment. You know, he was just saying it's not good. And I said, well, you know, maybe that's the case, although he seemed to want people to think that it was a bad investment. But, you know, so I basically kind of came up with like what gives, like Bitcoin doesn't return anything, you know, it's just,
which
a,
was
it's like
Munger's
gold.
Case.
Right. And so I tried to sit there and say, okay, what gives any asset value, any investment? You know, it's not like most of the time we just think it's a discounted stream of future cash flows, you know, and that's a component of it. But I've kind of identified what I think are like the six things that, you know, the six factors that give an asset value. And it's just changes in these six factors that move the price of a good. And I built this framework specifically around Bitcoin. And so, you know, the six are, you know, access, awareness, security, patina, uses collateral, and then, you know, intrinsic value, kind of the discounted, you know, cash flow type thing. So like getting through those, like, you know, access, you know, you could have a great asset out there, but if you can't buy it, then it's not going to go up in value. If it's not easy for people to buy, you know, if just, you know, techies can access it with, you know, complicated wallets or whatever, then you're not going to have broad access. But awareness is another, you know, companies spend, you know, billions of dollars on marketing campaigns to, you know, create awareness around their products. And the more aware people are, the more likely they are to own something. And this applies to anything, whether it's an investment or, you know, whatever it is. Security is a big one. And this is how I kind of came up with my thinking of what the tax is on a dollar. Like dollars are super secure, you know, but they're not completely secure. Like they lose value. They lose value because you pay a tax for holding them, but it's worth it. Like, you know, you pay your taxes in dollars and you buy stuff in dollars. It's not like you don't get anything for it, but you just have to pay a tax to own it. Or like gold is another one where, you know, from a security perspective, like there's a relatively limited amount of gold out there, but you know, if the price goes up, you know, 10x, they'll start digging up, you know, all of Colorado to get more of it, or they'll crash a satellite into an asteroid that's got a bunch of gold on it, move it into the, you know, orbit here eventually. So security is one. You know, you could buy a, you know, a bond from, you know, Namibia that yields a lot, but you don't know if the whatever the currency there is, you know, in other words, it's the security plays a role. And then patina is one, like, you know, you can think about how, I mean, like GameStop, for instance, you know, or some of these different, you know, meme type stocks, or it could be, you know, people may like Bitcoin because it's, you know, it shows that you're, you know, tech forward or libertarian thinking or whatever it is. Or they may like, you know, euros because they believe in the project, or they may like, you know, whatever it is. They may like Tesla stock because they want to be like Elon, you know. So patina can drive things. It's emotion, you know, can drive holding things because you like them. Baseball cards, you know, have value because people like to own them. And then obviously the return, you know, that you would get. But I mean, if you think about it, a bond, you know, a bond gives you a certain amount of interest, but if it's priced in dollars and you're getting paid interest in dollars, then you really need to subtract the, you know, the tax that you pay on dollars from the interest to see what you really get, and maybe a negative. So in that sense, maybe Bitcoin, you know, yield more than, you know, a bond, even though it doesn't have an interest rate because it's priced in Bitcoin, not priced in dollars. And then the biggest one is use as collateral. And so, you know, like for a long time, people like talked about Bitcoin as being similar to tulips. Like this was the constant, you know, narrative early on, particularly, which was the most absurd argument because there was no leverage in Bitcoin. You know, you couldn't borrow against it. You couldn't go to your bank and say, hey, I've got, you know, $1 million of Bitcoin in this wallet. Will you, you know, lend me money against it? They laugh at you, right? There was no leveraging it up. Well, the tulip mania came because people were actually able to take tulip bulbs and use them as collateral to borrow money, you know, which is, you know, completely absurd. Of course, it's going to blow up, but it's that process of leveraging something up that you know, gives it that huge value. So like the European sovereign debt crisis, right? The reason that that there was so much massive supply of all these things is because they were so leverageable. There was a zero haircut the ECB would apply to them. So basically, it's just massive amounts of, you know, every bond is perfect collateral. So there's demand for those bonds because you can turn them in for cash immediately. Anyway, those are the six things and that give value. And as it applies to Bitcoin, I mean, I think all of those are turning more positive. I mean, how many billions of dollars would it cost to launch a marketing campaign to get as much awareness for your product as Bitcoin gets, you know, for free? Access, obviously, it's improved dramatically with, you know, ETFs, you know, security. There's a very low tax on Bitcoin, and that monetary policy continues to tighten. You know, yeah, not everybody is able to secure their wallets, or there are other risks to security, but all these things kind of, each one of those, you know, items can kind of continues to improve.
Okay, let's finish on AI.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts about, are we in a hype bubble right now? And are we beginning the era of dramatic job loss and deflation because everything's going to be automated? And like, how is AI playing into your view of the world?
Okay, so I think it's just epic, like massive, massive, you know, revolutionary technology. And it's a top-down, I mean, it's a bottoms-up tech. So like, think about things like, you know, electricity, right? You know, we figured out how to, you know, manipulate electricity, that it still took, you know, over a generation before we started saying, oh, wait a minute, we can electrify factories over here and make them much more productive. And then the infrastructure that was required to do all that, it takes many, many years before you started to get the productivity benefits of harnessing electricity. Or railroads, you know, these are massive, or canals, massive upfront investments. And then you have to wait for a long time before, you know, you start to get the productivity boosts from them. Or, you know, the last mile of, you know, high-speed cable data, you know, going from dial-up to high speed. I mean, that took a huge amount of digging and infrastructure before you actually got that. But AI is like kind of the opposite. Those are all like top-down technological transformations that, you know, took huge amounts of capital up front, and then they over time permeated and you got the productivity benefits. But you know, AI and like ChatGPT, I mean, you have the most productive people in the economy suddenly making themselves much more productive simply by downloading an app. And so I think that's like, you had a lot of, you know, layoffs in Silicon Valley a couple of years ago. And I think the narrative at the time was that, you know, this is, you know, things are getting bad. And so they're, you know, battening down the hatches, when actually maybe it was more a function of, you know, they were just becoming so much more efficient because they were the earlier adopters of AI. So like, where it goes in the future, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, the only thing we know is that, I mean, technological change has been happening, and it's been happening at an accelerating rate for, you know, generations now. And it's likely to continue absent, you know, some sort of like hitting a great filter, like it's World War, where we destroy ourselves or something like that happens. And so in many ways, I just feel like you don't really have a choice but to sort of like embrace the changes that are coming.
Yeah.
And exactly what they are, you know, I don't know. But I think that it'll probably get harder in many ways to, you know,
compete.
And gain an edge as a human. So I don't know if I'm like prepared to. I'm glad I'm my age and not, you know, super young coming out. Although right now, you know, I'm sure it's like really interesting if you are coming out.
Bill Gurley and Brad Gerstner said on their podcast, they were just talking about kind of what you said, is traditionally companies get really big and then they slow down, they get bloated, and they just kind of start to die.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time in history, I mean, you look at like Fang or whatever it is now, they're actually gaining speed and gaining velocity at the size that they are, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's still been like one of the best trades is just keep betting on like the big seven.
Yeah, it has been. And it makes sense. You know, they're able to, you know, utilize, you know, these new technologies, you know, much more quickly than the rest of the world. And, you know, I mean, technology is growing faster and software is growing faster than the economy overall. And that'll probably continue. So
is there any theme I didn't ask you about? Cannabis?
Yeah. I mean, I think cannabis is just another one of these that's really interesting to me that, you know, you have, you know, it's roughly like in the United States, it's about $100 billion market right now. And or so maybe it's larger. And, you know, roughly, you know, 70% of that is illicit and 30% is, you know, legal, like state legal, whether it's medical or adult use in various states. And so, you know, you have this competitive landscape where the legal players, you know, they pay more taxes than any, they're more highly regulated and pay higher taxes than any other businesses in the United States. And so the cost of doing business is extremely high, and the low cost producer, marginal producer is the, you know, illicit market. They'll, you know, these are literally criminal enterprises. You know, they're not adhering to, you know, strict labor standards or environmental standards or paying any taxes or anything else. So the legal companies, you know, have a tough time competing, and it's been a tough theme because of that. But the flip side is that, you know, there are companies that have, you know, most have failed at this point, but there are some that have been able to survive and somewhat thrive in a world where, you know, it's not a level playing field at all. But I think inevitably, you know, the playing field will level out. And one of the things that's happened is cannabis has become more socially accepted. It's sort of become kind of de facto legal. Like, you don't have the kind of crackdowns that you used to have on, you know, illicit players. And so that's made, you know, the competitive environment even more difficult for legal players. But as you get, I do think enforcement's improving. The incentives for governments are very high. In Illinois, for instance, you know, cannabis producers pay more taxes than, you know, alcohol, than the state gets from alcohol. And so the incentives for governments to enforce laws, you know, are high. And then, you know, there's the potential for federal reform, whether it's banking or rescheduling, but there's constant other reform, just, you know, state level legalization, whatnot. So it seems like the tailwinds for the legal sector are starting to pick up. And from my perspective, it seems that, you know, what you've got is like this market share for the legal sector that's like 30% right now. But over time, whether it's, you know, 2 years or 10 years, you know, that goes to 100%. It's kind of like alcohol. You don't have like illicit alcohol, you know, makers out there. It's highly taxed, but you still don't have a bunch of, maybe there's some, but, you know, effectively, you know, it's all come into the legal scenario. And so basically what you're talking about over time is the marginal producers, the low cost producers of cannabis are like destined to go away, which means like hundreds of percent growth for, you know, if you just have the same size pie, it's hundreds of percent growth for, you know, the legal players. And then of course, you know, the potential for that market kind of expanding. And I think like young people, for instance, are much more likely to, you know, consume cannabis than they are. I don't know if they're more likely to consume cannabis than they are alcohol, but there's definitely a shift. The younger you get, the more biased you are in favor of cannabis over alcohol. It's definitely not as harmful. So I think there are a lot of like, you know, great tailwinds for the sector. It's not that easy to invest in, but it's a long-term theme that I have, you know, a lot of confidence in. I don't think I have as much confidence in that as I do like in, you know, Bitcoin long term, or, you know, this migration trade that I think is going to continue, particularly into Texas.
I think it's a good place to wrap up.
Awesome.
Thanks for joining me today, Mark.
Thank you. I hope I didn't babble along too
much. You're the best.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Jason, as we sat back years ago and were envisioning where Fort was going to go, we realized we needed to bring in a global workforce, a remote workforce that could work with us. And a few of the reasons why were obviously cost, which I think is the first thing that comes to everybody's mind. But then when we talk about shifts, a 24-hour shift, and maybe you can go a little further there, and some of the other benefits that we've realized as we've gone on. And now we sit here today in 2022. At the time we first had this was maybe 10 employees. Now we're at 46. Mm-hmm. And as you think about the next chapter and how we're scaling, it's almost inconceivable that we would do it without Relay Human Cloud. So can you just talk a little bit more to how the shifts work at Fort and the productivity and some of the other benefits that we've learned about working with a global workforce?
It's actually been pretty transformational from how we think about how we're going to not only get stuff done today, but how we're going to get stuff done in the future as we grow. And so when you start going down that path of thinking about you're going to start working with people on the other side of the world, right? There's a lot of questions that come up. How are we going to do it? How are we going to train them? How are we going to manage them? Who's managing them? All those things come up. What we found with Relay Human Cloud was that all those thoughts had already been taken care of and that we could focus on what type of talent is there that can join our team? Does it fit our need? And once we saw that all that thought and energy had already been put into the operational part of managing and running a team and the thing that we focus on here locally, then it was just a matter of finding the talent. And what I think that Relay Human Cloud has done really well is find a lot of great talent. And, you know, these are people that are highly educated, that can provide a ton of value to a company like ours that otherwise we can't find here. And obviously it's at a high or a extreme cost savings compared to what we could find here. So what we started looking for was how could we supplement what we currently do with the team overseas? And it started off for us from an accounting perspective. We have a lot of these things that are repetitive, task-driven, that just never end. And we knew that our team was taking on a lot of work during the day, which was limiting our ability to take on new properties. And so we have a choice. We can hire another accountant or another staff accountant or promote somebody and bring that person on. But we're really just trying to solve, at first, a repetitive task. So when we reached out to Relay Human Cloud, we discovered that not only could we solve that problem, we could get a very qualified person that could not only do that, help support on a lot of other things. And so it turned into we're trying to solve some repetitive tasks to bringing on more and more team members that were actually helping us grow our accounting department without having to bring on a lot of people here. And so that just continued to grow. So since then, we've brought on additional assistants, but it started with accounting. The benefit of having a team working globally is that you get the benefit of around the clock and it never ends. And so because we have a team here working on things, obviously the time runs out during the day, but there's things that they're going to come into work tomorrow and they're going to have to start doing that again. One of those things and a good example is cash reconciliations of every bank account. At Fort Capital, we have 50 bank accounts and there's cash reconciliations that have to happen every day. Well, that was something that locally a team had to come into work and start working on every day. Well, that just means there's other things they can't start working on. What happened immediately with our team at Relay Human Cloud was that overnight they were processing all those. They were doing all that accounting work on the back end so that when our team showed up in the morning, they could start on more important tasks that were happening locally directly related to the property. Mm. And that allowed us to create efficiencies. And so that's just one benefit. We can go through an entire list of things that we have discovered that overnight can be done to help increase the efficiency of the accounting team. That extends beyond the accounting team. It also extends to the property management team processing invoices. So Fort Capital, we have millions of square feet of industrial space across the country. And with that, you have a lot of invoicing that's happening at all times. You could name a million things, whether it's paying bills, contractors, tenants, whatever it is, there's a million invoices and that can all be processed in India overnight so that when our team comes in, they're not spending their day processing invoices, which allows us to get to more proactive accounting measures so that we're using our accounting team to actually push the company forward, not keep up with what's coming at us, right? And so we've found a ton of efficiencies by using or by having the 24-hour workday.
So following that up, it was also important to us because that could have been done anywhere, but we wanted it happening under one roof with people that we knew, that we worked with daily, that were part of our team. And so as you think about these people that are halfway across the globe, it still doesn't seem like they're, it seems like they're in the next room over.
Right. And that's a good point. And I think what's important to understand there is that this group of individuals that are working in India are working directly for our team. They are a part of our team. They're in our systems. They communicate with our team every day. They are not just an extension of our team. They are a part of our team. And so it is much, much different than if you go hire a third party service out there in the world that you're asking to process invoices, who you're having to send important data to that is, or might be sensitive, right? Information. We actually have all that internal, and this team is a part of that internal team. And so it's a much different way to look at outsourcing than if you're just outsourcing it, even here locally in America. There's a risk there that you're sending your data to somewhere else. This is all happening internally.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Fort Podcast. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform or hop on over to YouTube to watch full video episodes if that's what you'd prefer. For more information, you can check out thefortpod.com.